This is the Get Healthy 360 podcast, where we discuss topics related to your physical, mental, psychological, and spiritual health. Your host is Dr. Chris Ferguson, board certified in anesthesiology and pain management. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and you should consult your primary healthcare provider before making any decisions related to your health. And here's your host, Dr. Chris Ferguson.
Oh, one more thing before we start. If you like this episode, please consider rating us 5 stars. We would really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Today we have with us Dr. Adam Hill. He is a board certified pediatrician, oncologist, and he works with palliative care in the pediatric population. For anyone who has a child with cancer, this is the specialist you want to see. But in the world of medicine, physicians are people too, and they're human. And he is being very forthcoming, very brave in sharing his story of depression, anxiety, and addiction to alcoholism and how he really conquered that. And I would be the first to say that I'm sure that makes him a lot more empathetic, a lot more understanding, and a lot more personable physician. I can say if I had a child that had cancer, I'd want a physician that really understood what it was like to be sick and needed their healthcare professional to empathize with them and see them as a person and not just a disease. So Dr. Hill, thank you so much for in advance for sharing your story and all the work that you do.
Yeah, pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
So do you want to start at the beginning as to how your journey into medicine and how alcohol came into play?
Sure. I was raised in a small town in southern Indiana to a wonderful family in a small community. My father worked in healthcare for 40 years as a social worker and child and adolescent therapist. Worked with a lot of young individuals with their own mental health conditions, their own addiction stories. Ironically, at the time, I was living outside of that world, even inside my own home. But seeing his experience, seeing the way that he helped people and made a difference really inspired me. I knew from an early age that I wanted to be able to work in medicine and to help other people too. My entire family was really service-focused and community-focused and had a desire to put the needs of other people above themselves. And so that was ingrained in me from an early age. So I focused hard and I worked hard even in high school and planning to go to college to study medicine. That was a goal I had in mind from an early age. And my addiction story is convoluted. It's enmeshed with a history of depression and social anxiety as well. And it's easy maybe now to sort of tease that out and put it down on a plot for people to put pins in it of when different points of intersection occurred. But you know, the truth is I started drinking for the first time in high school, like a lot of people try. It had a calming sense of my nerves, my anxiety. I felt comfortable in my own skin. I calmed the social anxiety that stemmed from being bullied a lot as a young child. I remained really driven and focused though in my career and in my aspirations that I was an occasional binge drinker and really nothing more. And that continued, you know, through college as well, where I worked 2 jobs. I studied incredibly hard and focused on academia and a perfectionistic personality trait to achieve at a high level. And it really wasn't throughout the course of that time, I didn't struggle with depression. I continued to have social anxiety and feeling uncomfortable in large gatherings. I really didn't understand that I was an introvert until probably I was in my late 20s. But I did really well and did well during that time. And the first inklings of depression really didn't happen until I started into medical school.
And many people, so for anyone who has not gone to medical school, it's a very depressing time. I think I was. Everyone in my class was depressed, severely depressed at some time, just because you're alone, you're studying very, very, very hard. There's the financial pressure of you're paying a lot of money to be there. You have a lot of smart people that you're competing against where you're probably used to being on top of your class. And then suddenly everyone is smart. So you have to put in a lot of effort. A lot of the activities that grounded you, you can't participate anymore because you have to study, because if you don't study, you're going to fail the exam, et cetera. So you became depressed during medical school, like all people. And then what happened?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I struggled initially with an emotional leveling to an academic thudding down an achievement staircase or ladder that I used to be the smartest person in the room. I had tied my personal identity to that. And the first time I received a 63% on an anatomy review with red slash marks all over it, it was a deep personal insult to my core identity. And I didn't know what to do with that. The psychological leveling that occurs in those moments is something that I don't think we talk about enough in medical school. You know, from being top of my class and high GPAs to middle of the road or below average overnight. And I struggled with that. I struggled with that for most of the first year of medical school. And I was also struggling. I reflected and was writing about this recently, just about the indoctrinated inhumanity of some of the things that we go through in medical school, in anatomy lab and sawing through a human pelvis and not being prepared to emotionally process that as a 23-year-old human being that wasn't prepared to take on such a sensitive journey.
So I think that's an interesting point that in everyone wants a physician that's caring and understanding, and that's totally understandable and a very reasonable expectation. But I think, I don't want to speak for you, but it seems like these life stresses would contribute to or bring out an addiction problem if you're predisposed to it. And I think you hit on a really good point of the process of becoming a physician is a very dehumanizing process. A 23-year-old, like you said, you're sawing through a pelvis of a person, or you're sawing into their head and dissecting their face to learn the anatomy.
Yeah, I didn't know how to process that information or where to put it. And it seemed like I existed in an emotional purgatory for some amount of time after that. And, you know, and we didn't talk about it. We didn't create spaces to be able to process that. And it was just on to the next thing continuously. And so I struggled with that. It was sort of there's a lot of literature and data out there to suggest the environmental risks, occupational hazards of markedly increased rates of depression once you step into medical school. And I was no different in that. I think I actually went to a community doctor and asked for my thyroid to be checked, thinking I had hypothyroid. I was fatigued and slept all the time and couldn't focus and didn't want to get out of bed. And as soon as I crossed off that diagnosis, the expectation was just on to the next thing.
So when did the drinking become a problem?
Yeah, so I did make it through medical school. I actually, late in medical school, broke my leg playing basketball, which was a self-care activity for me. And during that time, really, depression became really evident and clear. And so at that time, I actually sought help and counseling. I started on an antidepressant and I did well with a couple times of having setbacks or trialing off antidepressants with a treatment team. But I didn't know what I know now, sort of about the stigma and concerns of ramifications and potential punishments that can come with a mental health history story in the medical profession. I just sought help because I needed it. And my family asked me if I needed it. So I did that. And really through residency, even I continued to do fairly well and was stable on antidepressants. And it was really starting the next journey in fellowship that my active alcoholism story started.
Do you want to comment on or elaborate on that, what you just said about how there's a stigma or ramifications of seeking mental health as a physician?
Sure. Well, I think there's a reality and then there's a fear. And often the fear overwhelms the reality for a lot of people. The fear is, and the common perception is, that seeking any type of mental health treatment or counseling may alter your career path, your opportunities in the future. It'll be a red flag in your professionalism chart for the rest of your life and career. And that's a very widespread and common fear. I think the reality and the truth is that there's some reality and truth to that for a lot of people. When you go to apply for positions in a hospital, their credentialing paperwork asks, have you ever been treated for mental health conditions? Are you on medications for mental health conditions? Have you ever been in addiction treatment? Have you ever been hospitalized? And can openly ask those questions about mental health while not being able to ask about your physical health condition, which is deemed discriminatory against ADA. And those policies still persist, and not only on the institutional level, but with insurance malpractice carriers who set your ability to have malpractice, with disability insurance for providers, for healthcare professionals, and then also the state level when you're trying to get a medical license. There's still a lot of states that can ask those questions openly. And sometimes even if they ask them, they may not influence you getting a medical license or not, but the fact is it could. And people still ask them. So it causes still a lot of fear and anxiety for people who have these conditions about openly seeking help.
Which I think is definitely worth working on from a policy standpoint to change. So fast forward then to the fellowship. So you finished a pediatric residency, which I think is one of the most challenging specialties because you're dealing with little people who can't really tell you what's wrong. And then you did a fellowship in oncology. So how did the alcohol use manifest itself there?
Yeah. So partial to the story is that I've been living under the cumulative weight of sharing and other people's suffering for years and years, and seeing a 6-month-old baby die in the emergency room while I'm doing chest compressions for 35 minutes on Christmas Day, or taking care of oncology patients that pass away in the intensive care unit. And all those stories continue to build, and I wasn't taking the time to process them. So I think as part of the backdrop of the story into going into the next challenging career in oncology was that I'd never really taken time to decompress about years and years of that burden of a privilege of taking care of other people. So transitioning then into a fellowship, I left family and friends, moved across the country. My wife and I had met when I was in residency and then gotten married. We moved across the country to start this new professional challenge. And I felt like I was intellectually prepared for this, that I could take care of patients with complex disease, work in pediatrics, but I didn't know really the void that would be left of leaving family and friends and support network and community, how much that would affect me. And so that really began a process of struggling again with depression. And then on top of that, home-based call where I was on call for a week at a time and barely sleeping and feeling like I was at the bottom of the totem pole again. I'd had this expectation that I'd finally be able to practice medicine with autonomy and the medicine I'd always hoped for. And when that didn't happen, which is true in pediatrics a lot, that you delay gratification for a long period of time before you can practice on your own, the absence of that change and the grind and the sleep deprivation and just the emotional baggage became a burden that I didn't know how to handle. So I spiraled deeper into depression over the course of a year or a year and a half in the new role, with just what I felt like realistic expectations and a no reprieve. I remember being on vacation, in quotation marks, and getting called while I was standing at Disney World to call a family about their bone marrow biopsy results and to talk to them about really difficult, devastating news while I was standing outside a theme park ride and children were laughing in the background. You know, that was supposed to be my break or time away to reset, and it just never came. And through that grind, I just continued to struggle until this moment that I started to realize that there was a solution, and had this tunnel vision flashback of how I felt in moments of being uncomfortable in my own skin or anxious back in high school or college. And I reached for a bottle to try to seek that calming sensation again.
Because you're in training, and how did you drink and manage your clinical duties and then manage your relationship with your spouse?
Yeah, those are two very different questions and very good ones. So the truth is, and I've had the privilege of working with a lot of individuals inside and outside of medicine with their own addiction stories over the past handful of years. And especially within medicine, people are really good at hiding it. And I've had 6 colleagues die from suicide in my short career. And every one of them that I can remember working up until the last day or two before they died. So I was no different. I put on a brave face and a faux smile and grinded through the day and did my work. I never hardly ever missed a day of work. You know, I drank in the evening. So, and if I was on call, then I simply went without, which really was the point at which I knew I had a problem, or I should have known that I had a problem, because then I would feel miserable and terrible. I couldn't calm my senses. I didn't have any coping skills to be able to process all the emotional internal turmoil I was feeling. So I worked and I grinded through, and then I would leave work at 4:30 or 4 o'clock and drive straight to the liquor store. I was a secretive closet drinker, and so I drank in the confines of my garage or the backyard or in the car or when my wife wasn't home. So I tried to hide it away. I didn't go out to bars or restaurants. And so I thought I was hiding it for a long time. The truth is, so that's the work piece. The home piece is that my wife knew all along I was living in denial that she didn't know or didn't care, but she did. And oftentimes her love felt confrontational. When she would try to address it or bring it up, then I immediately got defensive and pushed her away. And that process went on for months.
I'm looking for advice for other people who have a spouse that is going through this. And I think it would be difficult because if I can imagine what it's like to be the spouse of someone that you love and you care about them, but I think it's actually harder because you're a functional professional and you're doing a very difficult job. And it would be easy to make the argument, I am training, I am working, I'm taking care of people, I have responsibilities, and I'm doing my job well. So what I do in my own time to manage my stress and depression and anxiety and all these other things, if that's my coping mechanism, then leave me alone. But obviously your spouse cares about you, so they would identify the problem, but yeah. I can see it being a very difficult situation for them to be in.
Oh, it was an impossible one. And I wish I could put my wife on speakerphone right now. And she has an incredible journey and story to tell, too. And her perspective is invaluable in this space. I think you spoke about some of the rationalizations that I had in my mind, too, about this is how I cope and this is how I function and this is how I get through this process. And I convinced myself of that, too. I think she saw that there was a larger problem, definitely before I did, but well before anybody else as well. And she tried desperately to get me help with a loving patience for a long time. And I just wasn't ready to hear it. And I think over that time, it's when any alcoholic would tell you one or two drinks a night becomes three or four, becomes five or six. And, you know, from wine bottles of vodka to pints to fifths, and an evolution that continued just to be able to get the same numbness that I was seeking.
And others people have spoken to, what was the turning point or the rock bottom or the thing that made you decide, or not necessarily rock bottom, but what was the thing that made you decide, I have an issue with this and I need to fix this issue?
Yeah. So for me, on a Saturday morning, early fall, I drove out to a state park with a plan to end my own life. I had spent weeks spiraling into depression and coping with alcohol and had started to conceptualize ways to die. I visited a gun store where I actively inquired about the process of buying a 9mm handgun. I envisioned and sitting in my garage with the car door shut and the garage door rolling down behind me, and envisioned all these sort of suicidal fantasies that really built up to the point of having an act plan. And so I drove out to the park and I sat there all day underneath a tree and really deeply contemplated how everything in my life had gone wrong and how everyone in the world would be happier when I was gone. I played out these videotape montages of like the worst moments of my own life and some self-deprecating highlight reel.
So did anyone know, or did anyone in your life have insight into how bad it was?
So The truth is that in recovery, a lot more people have reached out to me, which is a whole nother interesting topic to discuss, about how they notice certain things or signs or symptoms, and that they had a guilt about not saying something sooner in my struggles. But the truth of the moment was my wife didn't even know the depths of the suicidal thoughts or plans. I had a couple of close friends that I worked with that I entrusted with bits and pieces or convenient pieces of my story. So they knew that I was struggling with depression and a little bit about coping with alcohol, but still didn't know the depths of the problems because I didn't let them in or let anybody in to see it. Isolation in itself is part of the symptomatology pathway for depression, and it was self-fulfilling, and I wanted to be left alone.
At this point in your life, were you still in training or were you fully done your training?
I was still in training. And really, you know, the rock bottom moment, which I prefer using the term cornerstone because it was really the foundation from which the rest of my life has been built, was the transition between first and second year of fellowship. For a lot of academic fellowships that are 3 years, second and third year can be more research-based or working on projects and less clinical care. It's definitely that way in oncology. And I'd found great meaning and purpose from working with patients. That's why I went into medicine in the first place. And that shift and that change where then I was in a bench research lab, less and less exposure to meaningful interaction, was part also of that transition of when the cornerstone moment occurred.
So just to help me understand, and I think other people listening to understand, it's hard for me to get my head around how you could be suffering so much to the point where you were willing to take your own life, but still functioning as a pediatric resident or a pediatric fellow taking care of patients, because it seems just doing that alone and not having such emotional distress is stressful enough. Training itself is stressful enough, in addition to all these other things, compounded by keeping it together to the point where people didn't really know what you were going through.
I think the truth is that the process itself of training in medicine teaches us how to survive that depth of suffering and turmoil, and to push it down and to move on to do the next thing. I think I am a product of that type of Pygmalion effect, and where we're expected to perform to a higher level of standard. And I think it was just part of how I was taught that I could work hard, I could grind, I could put myself on the back burner because someone else is always sicker. The patient is always sicker. The needs assessment is always outside of us. And we happily sometimes just concede that as part of what it means to work in medicine, that my needs don't matter. My health doesn't matter as much as somebody else's. So it's relatively easy to do that. I mean, I had done it for a decade before active alcoholism. So to me, it was one and the same.
So you had your cornerstone moment. And then what did you do next? How did you go from being severely depressed, suicidal, to turning around? And then how did you eventually get into treatment? Was there an event that caused you to get into treatment, or was it an institutional thing that made you go into treatment, or did you do that yourself?
Yeah. So the moment of being in the woods, I had a moment of grace that happened in my life, and I called my wife after being out there all day. And it was really in those moments that my recovery began. I disclosed to her how I was feeling, and I wish I could tell you the specific details even. It wasn't like some heroic event happened, being carried out of the woods onto shoulders and a new life began. But that's when my recovery started. She helped me get back into counseling with a psychiatrist. I, a few days later, met with my boss and discussed my ongoing struggles. And it was at that time then I had to sort of institutionally report and was mandated into a physician recovery program and really started on a path to recovery. I really had hoped that the worst was behind me. In those moments, I was filled with guilt and shame and resentment and anger and still being defensive. But then I had a physician that asked me if I really wanted to do this and if I really wanted to seek help or treatment that I really want. I was dumbfounded that here I was actively suicidal, an active addiction, undertreated depression, and somebody was asking me if I just wanted to walk out the door and forget that we ever had this conversation. You know, it pertains to the question you asked earlier and the statement about the professional ramifications and all of the things we discussed, but the person was asking me if I wanted to open myself up to the stigma of this world or to professional licensing questions and policy questions, etc. But I couldn't believe that it had matriculated down to a point where that level of counseling was being given to people who were actively looking for ways to end their life. And that deeply disturbed me and has been for me still many years later, a point at which I consider a turning point of and a catalyst for why I would speak up years later.
So I'll share some of my experiences with medicine. And I was told by, so there are other fields in medicine. So there are physicians and there are nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and there are nurses and physical therapists, et cetera. And the other fields, the training is you come to work, you have a specific punch card, like you punch in, you punch out, you have a time card, you're on during those times, but no one calls. And people can correct me if I'm wrong, but no one really calls other professions when they're off. Whereas as a physician, it's almost expected that you're always on. Even if you're at home, you're expected to be available on vacation, like you said, or not. And the advice that I received during my training was when you're working, your job comes first. And it doesn't really matter what happens if your parent died or you're having some relationship issue with your spouse or you're depressed or what have you. When you're at work, you put on your game face and you get it done. It doesn't matter if you've been working for 36 hours, which every physician has. They've worked for 36 hours straight with no sleep. You just go. Doesn't matter how tired you are. Doesn't matter if you haven't eaten. Just get it done. And in that culture, there's very little sympathy for any sort of weakness at all. By weakness, I mean, I need to go to the bathroom or I need something to drink because I haven't drank anything for 8 hours or I'm hungry because I haven't eaten anything for 12 hours, let alone I am depressed or I am sad.
Yeah, I agree that there's a huge variability in the institutional and practice-based culture surrounding that, but that's an overarching, I think, cultural expectation. And one that has been, I see, changing and have a lot of hope will continue to move forward in positive change. But it is, and that was part of my story. And I had to learn in recovery about healthy boundaries and limits and how to set expectations for myself. I had to learn about success and failure and what that means to me and not in terms of what it meant at the professional level or for academia or for hospital-based medicine or not chasing outcome measures or mortality numbers or CLABSI numbers or, but what does success mean to me and how is it valuable? And that been a huge part of my recovery is saying no and setting limits and prioritizing my family and my wife. And now I have two young children and finding ways to do that so that I'm not always on and people know so that I've set a new expectation around what I'll give and what I won't for somebody who is actively suicidal, who wasn't promised these days that I'm living. I'm not going to sacrifice that again. And to me, if other people struggle with that, then okay.
So to circle back to what we were talking about in the very beginning, to be a pediatric oncologist, it's a competitive program and there's a lot of weight on your shoulders. So I would think it's very easy to sacrifice family time, to sacrifice your own personal health, your own personal health maintenance things, because you're dealing with a child with cancer. And obviously you went into this field to help someone. So if you read a few more textbooks, if you attended a few more conferences, if you did a little bit more work, you might be able to find the answer to help this child, which I think every parent would want, that obsessive, I am going to fix this one way or another. However, if you destroy yourself in the process, that doesn't really help anyone. And going through the issues with depression, alcoholism, possibly some professional stigma, can you comment on how that impacts the care that you give to your patients? And especially in the context of you're treating children with cancer who have pain. This is compounded by there's an opioid epidemic. So there's the push to prescribe less narcotics, but you have patients in pain. And if you treat their cancer, then you have this chronic opioid issue that you legitimately are prescribing to help them with their pain. And then you have patients who have palliative care, meaning that everyone has done everything they can, and they're just not going to survive this illness.
Yeah, I mean, there are complex intersections, I think, with several of the statements that you made. There is this overarching continued push for what a larger culture expects of medical professionals and putting them up on a pedestal and having this superhero cape of expectations that has done a disservice to a lot of people. And those continued cultural pressures that we put, not just on the individuals that work within the halls of the hospital, but on the institutions themselves, that it's also a perfection and it's binary. It's win or loss. It's perfection or failure. And even with outcomes and cure. And when we place a system under that pressure and bolster it up by the cultural expectations that we must and will do better and better in a chaotic, uncontrolled world where so many variables are not accounted for into this equation, then we set people up for failure. We set healthcare professionals up for failure when they're doing a CPR and it fails to revive a patient, and then the provider walks away and says, it's my fault. I should have done more. I should have been better. And then we set the family and patients up for failure in the ways that we promise immortal solution to sometimes things that we don't have modern day answers to. And so in that system that says success versus failure, I see both sides. I see the daily struggles and the burden it puts on healthcare professionals every day, that then shame and blame and guilt and sometimes litigation follows. But then I also see it in the burden it places on a family who say, we need to do one more phase one trial. We need to do one more round of epinephrine. We can't give up because the next fix and solution is 5 minutes around the corner. And it's a dangerous, slippery slope both ways. And so what I see in that now, as somebody who has my own healthcare story, it levels me and allows me to have a different empathy for people that are going through their own experiences, both professional and patient and family, that I won't pretend to know what it's like for them to live in their shoes, but I want to give them a chance to be able to tell their story and so that I can learn more about what they're experiencing. And when you speak to the complicated issues of addiction and opioid prescriptions and an ongoing epidemic as well, I think we all have to be mindful that accountability and policy don't equal punishment and shame. And we can be structured in our way that we approach those so that we limit the harm done to individuals in that situation. But if you have rigid pathways and policies and structures in place that don't adapt to human stories, and you choose policy over people, then unintentionally good people get chewed up in that system as well. So I try to keep my lens and my focus open to really understanding people's stories that are struggling with mental health, that are struggling with addiction, with chronic pain, that are struggling with complex medical conditions, so that I have a better sense of where they're coming from before I just execute some blanket strategy or statement upon their life.
I am sure that with your background, especially with your experience with pain and suffering, even though I'm going to assume you've never had a child with cancer, but because of your past, it allows you to empathize better with the parents and children who are going through a very stressful and very painful period of their life.
I think it has taught me that I don't know what I don't know. And it's taught me to patiently, presently step into that space with an ear to listen and to learn about what other people are going through, because I've been the one that the stereotypical statements have been said about, or that I've been lumped into a diagnosis or a box or a disease, that I'm just an alcoholic, or I'm an impaired physician, or somebody with mental health problems, or I'm mentally ill, and that I've been left into those boxes without people actually asking me the depth of my story, which is why I'm grateful for opportunities like this to share. And I try to have that same openness, no matter what the diagnosis, no matter what the family dynamic, so that I can learn more and not come in with prejudice or assumption in the first place.
And in my experience, it seems that's the biggest complaint that people have when they see a physician or a healthcare provider, that they're not really listened to and they're seen more as their disease as opposed to a person with all these other things going on. For example, someone comes in and they have back pain. They don't want to be seen as someone with back pain, but they want to be seen as, say, a 50-year-old gentleman who's been happily married his whole life, who's been an athlete, and playing sports has caught up with him, and he wants to maintain his activity. So help him with his pain, not just patient in room 3 with back pain.
38-year-old with history of depression and suicidal ideation, suicide attempt, and an alcoholic. That doesn't encapsulate me, my life, my story, my journey, my recovery. And it doesn't for the patients and families under my care either. 6-year-old with acute lymphoblastic leukemia isn't a disease. She loves unicorns and blankets and her baby brother and running down the hallways and loves a bedtime story at night. I think we shouldn't be surprised that we stereotype people into those boxes of disease, because that's how medicine functions, right? I mean, we assign people to categories so that we can better predict disease pathways, trajectories, treatments, and have prognosis abilities. And the scientific method relies upon standardizing or normalizing variability and our uniqueness of the ways that make us perfectly imperfect human beings. And it doesn't care about that. And scientific progress in terms of publications and research and data-driven relies that we do that. I think the greatest gap, though, in holistic healing and in our ability to take care of people is that we fail to acknowledge the harm that that does individuals within that system, that it's just as important, if not more important, to learn the humanistic part of people's experiences and to highlight those and to show those up as a valuable and meaningful part of what they're going through. So I've learned that through a lens of recovery myself.
So do you have a message then for, say, hospital administrators who may be listening to this, or even other physicians or healthcare professionals that are not where you are now, but they're in the beginning parts where they're suffering with depression, anxiety, potentially a substance abuse issue?
I think my first message to anybody is you're not alone. And there are so many of us out there that have been on similar journeys, who have found help, and there's so much hope for you. And I hope people hear that, and I hope that it's meaningful and will allow people the courage and bravery to step forth and seek their own treatment and help. You know, more and more over the last few years, I've been encouraged by how many people are standing up, stepping out, sharing their experiences, sharing their stories. Because the truth is, there's an army of us out there. And we work in the medical profession now where greater than 50% of our colleagues are distressed in medical institutions. And we have 1.5 to 2.5 times the rates of suicides. We have some of the highest rates of untreated depression. And there is a majority of us out there. And I think the sooner that we take off the blindfolds and start sharing these empowered and emboldened voices, then we can realize, wow, we can make a huge difference in this space. So, you know, I hope people know that. And I hope people are starting to see that. And on the back end of that, what I encourage all people to do is be a voice of change in your own sphere of influence. It may be 2 people, it may be 10 people, it may be 200. But if you can create a safe space where vulnerability can come organically forth, and people can authentically share their own stories, their own fears, their own worries, their own concerns, then you've done an amazing service. And if we can build silos of that over time, then that brush fire of vulnerability will catch, that silo after silo will connect. And maybe in that movement, we can change the culture of medicine. And that's what I hope.
And what would be your message to patients? Because what's glossed over in this conversation is the amount of time and effort a physician will put into their specialty. So you do pediatric oncology and palliative care. You don't do anything else. So you're very, very good at that. Countless hours put into studying it and really trying to treat cancer as best you can. But you also have that other side where you would strike me as a very empathetic and caring, genuinely emotionally vested in your patient. The downside is there are other physicians like that, but there are also other physicians that will do the medical care, but they don't do the emotional support, which sometimes that's all you have, or sometimes it's equally as important, if not more so. What is your advice to, say, patients or people listening to this as far as how to pick a physician if they have a serious medical issue?
Well, I mean, I think you made a couple of different points and then asked a great question. Over the past 5 years, I mean, I work primarily in palliative care. I don't practice oncology on a daily basis other than to say that, I mean, I take care of children with cancer all the time in a different aspect of their care and within palliative care. I think that what I hope that the general population at large understands is that individuals in medicine often that are the most empathic, the most invested individuals often come from a space of understanding what it is like to be sick themselves in some form or context, and that it has been viewed as a weakness, as a moral corruption, as a red flag that somebody has their own mental health condition. But I think the truth is that probably some of the best doctors, nurses, therapists, people that you know have their own stories too, and they're exceptional at their jobs because of it, not despite it. And that's a powerful reframe that I see and that I live every day, knowing people's stories, and that I hope that individuals continue to be given that chance to show how compassionate they are despite whatever their own medical condition is. And so to me, that's really important.
Dr. Hill, thank you very much for sharing your story. It takes a lot of courage to especially be this vulnerable to the whole internet world, and also sharing your very well thought out thoughts on alcoholism recovery and the way that the medical profession treats its own, which is not very kindly, typically.
I do think that it is getting better. There are a lot of forces and movements over the last few years that are working in this space, and I do have a lot of hope that it'll continue to get better and better year after year. But I also acknowledge that it's going to continue to take a lot of us invested into this space of caring for our medical workforce while acknowledging that it actually improves patient safety, patient outcomes, and patient experience too, that they're intrinsically linked. And so everyone should have a vested interest in this space. I do think that you'd made a very poignant comment on the question before too about just when individual healthcare professionals are in that space and who feel deeply for their patients, who are how they do that and continue to do this work. I would tell you that I'm never going to tell somebody else how to feel, how to practice, how to live, how to be, and what's going to work for you or not. Part of recovery is finding that out for yourself. And recovery can mean a wide range of things. It doesn't have to be addiction or depression. But I do know that there are ways, and I've found this out, where you can delve deep into the emotional experiences of another person and find a way to extract the meaning, the purpose, the marrow out of that. Take something away that you can deem a success, a moment of impact, a moment of value, no matter what the outcome, and that can sustain and it can fuel you for years and years to come. And I fear that we often teach people to distance themselves away, or we actually create pathways of apathy that you shouldn't feel, you shouldn't love your patients, you shouldn't get emotionally attached, you shouldn't cry with them, you shouldn't be, you shouldn't go to funerals. But the truth is, some of those are the most human things that you could do in that moment. And if you live true to that humanity, you can actually find a deeper sense of what it means to be a healer. And to me, that has been the greatest gift of what I've learned on my journey.
I think that was so profound. I have nothing to follow that with. So again, I want to thank you for your bravery and courage coming forward. And I think it takes true courage to really be vulnerable. It's much easier to just hide and not share your story. I'll include in the show notes your Twitter handle and any other social media you're willing to share. And from what I've seen on your Twitter handle, you're always open to talking to other people, especially when they're struggling with things. So if anyone's listening, I would encourage you to reach out. I'm sure Dr. Hill can be super helpful, if nothing else but to listen. So again, thank you so much for taking the time.
No, I appreciate the opportunity. It's great speaking with you today.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast,
please leave a comment on the Get Healthy 360 Facebook page and consider subscribing to this podcast. Thanks.